Talking about young adult literature is not for the faint of heart. There's fashion atrocities, queer subtext, problematic love interests, and that's just for a start. But never fear, cause Carrie and Marie are here, and this is Go Your Own YA. Hi, and welcome to Go Your Own YA. I'm Carrie.
And I'm Marie. Carrie, what did we read this week?
This week we read How I Paid for College, a novel of sex, theft, friendship, and musical theater by Mark Acedo.
That's it. That's the book.
That tells you everything you need to know. All right. Our job is done here. Good night, everybody.
So let's start with the content warnings.
There's a lot of content warnings for this one.
There's so many content warnings. And there's going to be a big philosophical discussion about what young adult literature is and what young adult literature owes its readers. But please stay with us, especially if you're Mark Acedo. We promise. Okay, this book is from the point of view of a 17-year-old, well-to-do Italian-American boy in 1983, New Jersey.
Westfield, to be exact.
He doesn't have the internet. He has one good English teacher who is kind of not a great teacher, except if you're Edward Zani, and musical theater. Like, that is his exposure to other cultures. He's shitty about trans people. He's shitty about Black people. Surprisingly, not shitty about Iranian people. And also surprisingly not shitty about fat people. This is not a book I would put out for Pride Month. This is a book I would assign with content warnings because I'm not a monster in a class about AIDS era historical literature.
Yeah, I think that about covers it.
Yeah. There's also a lot of sex. There's a lot of sex happening between underage people. There is some sex that happens between an adult and an underage person. And it is, we're going to say, it's weird because he's just about to turn 18, but he feels weird about it. So we'll say it's on the assault spectrum. He feels uncomfortable. He didn't like it going into it, and he didn't like it coming out of it. And, yeah. And there is definitely a trans slur. There is definitely weirdness about fat people, but not from Edward.
Yes.
Some Edward self-directed, which is, we're going to say not as bad as it could be, but there's also a wonderful fat character who is not forced to lose weight by the narrative, who is not a problem, who is not a makeover waiting to happen. She is a fully actualized character with a story arc and a big family and really great dialogue. So, yeah, there's a lot of awkward stuff to unpack with this book. And there's also a lot of things which are worthwhile in this book. Our friend Lisa, friend of the podcast, said, "It can be true that a book can be inspiring to some people and the same book can hurt people. And we can hold those truths equally. And what you do with that depends, like, on what your, you know, your relationship is to readers. Are you a librarian? Are you a teacher? Are you a viewer? Are you an author, et cetera, et cetera?" We're just podcasters.
Now, I don't know. I mean, we've both read this book multiple times. It sounds like you came out of it this time having had a much harder time with it.
I did. I felt very conflicted. And like, this book is from 2004. And going by Mark Acedo's blog, he's grown up a lot since then. And I think that if he revisited it, and plus he did a stage show of this, a one-man stage show, and maybe content had been rewritten, maybe he had, you know, maybe he would go back and change things himself if there was a reissue. Like, I don't want to put words in his mouth. It's just, I think that it's not coming from a place of malice, but a place of ignorance. And reading this would depend on a place of an ignorance and also sort of a truth of reflecting the ugliness of, like, white supremacy, sexism, racism, all of that good stuff. And, you know, being honest to where this, you know, I don't know how much of it is based on his own life, and I really would love to find out.
Lots of it. I have the inside connection from someone who may or may not have been Nady Noodleman. He has told me he wasn't, but I think that Nady Noodleman owes a little bit to Gary Marr.
Now that we've talked about all the things that might, you know, I want to, you know, it sounds really harsh, might hurt people, but it's the reality. If you're writing a character who says and does hurtful things, then you have to live with the reality that your character hurts people. And it's something that, you know, Edward, even in the narrative, grapples with. I've talked a lot. Carrie, you should talk about this book.
I mean, I'm letting you lead this discussion because things really affected you this time around. And, you know, I want to honor that.
You know, when I was a teenager, in all of the ways besides the, you know, theft, lies, attempted murder, blackmail, extortion. And
they only talk about murder. No one has ever actually, there's no attempted murder.
That's true. And the kidnapping of a Buddha. I was in a lot of ways like Edward, and my friends mm-hmm. were like the play people. We were mostly, you know, middle class, immigrant descended white middle class kids living on Staten Island with a penchant for musical theater and a need to make our own fun because we did not drink and we did not party. Although there is plenty of that in this book, everybody kind of loses their taste for it pretty quickly. So this is hard. And, you know, if a podcast about somebody grappling with their feelings about a book that is hurtful to people is not your cup of tea, we have 22 other episodes. They're a lot of fun, and they have a lot less conflict than this one. Except, like, there's a couple of them where we've disagreed on the book. I think it's when we've read a different book.
Yes. That's exactly what it was.
So, yeah. I guess a lot of my feelings in this book are wrapped up with the I at 32, I'm still trying to do the work to, if I can't be a good person, at least to have good behavior. And, you know, this is a book which in some places revels in its bad behavior. And I don't know how to handle those parts of myself. I don't know how to have a problematic fave is what I'm saying.
No, I totally understand. And I think that's completely, completely valid. And I know that there are things about this book that probably are still, like, really important to you and, like, mean something to you and bring you joy. And it's hard to come back to something that has brought you so much joy and look at it and be like, wow, there are some really difficult things about it and some really unfortunate things about it.
And I think it really hurts, like, just looking at that era of literature and how basically it was, like, almost nothing for trans teenagers, especially for trans feminine teenagers, and to have sort of this let's dress the nerd up as a girl, a really ugly girl, and the use of the S-slur, and, like, that this is, like, part of the tiny, tiny representation in books that were out at this time is really hurtful. And it's, I mean, it's the kind of thing which drives me to write the stuff that I write, which is mostly, like, happy apocalyptic fiction with dinosaurs and werewolves. and trans characters to which nothing really bad ever happens, because, you know, we have a lot of that. And also, it's not my place to write because I'm cis. Yeah. So, if I'm getting emotional over it, it's because, like, this particular aspect of, like, you know, literature hurting people is closer to my heart and in my life a little more than, you know, I'm white. I can't speak to the racism, but I do recognize the things which are hurtful. And I also recognize a reflection of what, like, North Jersey and Staten Island teenagers are like with each other, and the classism and racism inherent, and, like, the things that were said, you know, reflected in 1983 were the same things that were happening in 2003 when I graduated in high school.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a lot of feelings. Hi.
That's what the podcast is for.
So it's really hard because there's so many things I love about this book. But, I mean, there's the bigger question, which I've been talking to you on and off all day about it, that is, what is a YA book? And is the idea of a YA book and social liberation in it, like, are they always interconnected?
Well, I would not classify this as a YA book at all.
I wouldn't. And it wasn't even, it was marketed a little bit as one, but I'm pretty sure it was under an adult imprint. I know the sequel was. And
yes,
I've seen
the
it
sequel was for sure
shelved in both adult sections and on a YA table or a display, but not in the YA section.
I saw it shelved in the YA section. That is how I found it. Back when it came out in 2004. It has a very bright and wacky cover.
Yes.
And it drew me in instantly. It was like, this looks like fun. So yeah, it was right there on the YA shelf. And, you know, it was around that same time that I also found The Museum of Mary Child on the YA shelf.
Yes.
And, you know, that is a solid middle grade book. This is definitely an adult book, and there are many different reasons why.
So, essentially marketing categories are a whole bunch of meow.
Yeah, but we know that. We talk about that every week. That's no surprise to anyone who has listened to this podcast before.
But I think especially with this book, because it's, you know, I guess the first thing is we would have to define what a YA book is and how it differs from an adult book. Like, for you, what is that difference?
That is a fabulous question. You know, I hate to say that it's like porn, and I know it when I see it, but it totally is.
Yes. And this book is also like porn.
Yes. The sex scene. Okay, I was thinking about this on my way home from work today. Now, I did not have sex in high school. And so maybe I am ignorant as to how amazing 17-year-old sex lives are. But I don't think that they're as amazing as they are in this book. Everyone seems to be pretty, like, very skilled and very sophisticated, and I don't know.
And in a day without, like, Scarlet Teen and Rookie and Teen Vogue, like, where are you getting that information?
No kidding.
Like, all they had was The Joy of Sex. I'm not even kidding. Like, that's the book all the 70s parents had hidden under the bed.
Yep.
Not mine, because we're Catholic. I know, I looked for it.
Yep. Yeah, same here. People talked about that book being in everyone's house, and I was like, my parents are doing a really good job of hiding. Oh, Catholicism.
Yeah, I did find a whole bunch of my mom's, like, books from her college class on human sexuality, which was quite interesting. Like, these little 70s and 60s, like, pulpy psychology paperbacks.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, talking about a whole bunch of weird stuff. But that didn't answer most of my questions, and I definitely don't think it would have taught me any of the things that Ed Zani knew.
No. Yeah, so this feels like a book written by an adult for adults. He's at a bit of a distance, and in the actual book, Edward Zani is, you know, like maybe a few months removed from the events of the story, but it feels like much longer ago. It feels like Mark Aceto looking back at his high school years.
Like, this is a deeply, like, Gen X-y book. This is, like, so much 80s culture. And it's written, I mean, I hesitate to say historical fiction because I was born in 1985. And that hurts me. And I know you were alive in 1983.
I have many memories. My best Christmas ever was in 1983.
Awesome. I was born during Live Aid. I mean, not like, it was on the TV at the hospital. Like, mom didn't push me out into the crowd.
That would have made for a very different life story.
Yes. A really good YA novel. That I would say the tone of the book is written towards contemporaries. It's like what you say, like, there are a lot of books, the sort of the, is Romana Clef the the picaresque novel of the young gay man. And they're all written in this way. They've all got that shadow of AIDS. They've all got really wild happenings. They've all got the importance of found family in them. It is of that tradition of novel. Whereas YA, you know, can be historical, but help me out here.
Well, let's jump ahead a few years from the publication of this book to when I was writing my first book, which still lives on my hard drive. But it was a NaNoWriMo novel to start with, and I said it in the 90s just for fun because that was when I went to high school and I wanted to do this kind of Betsy Tacy thing where I was looking back at those years and using that to kind of inform the narrative, and also because it was NaNoWriMo and you can be self-indulgent as hell during that month. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up, you know, getting the interest of an agent, and one of the first things she said was, like, well, why the setting? I enjoyed it because I'm a few years younger than you are, but, you know, we're going to have to make it contemporary. And I was like, I know. It was fun, though.
I almost feel that the people who, gatekeep is a very strong word, but the people who can look at YA a little further away from actually being in the YA world worry more about contemporariness of things than actual people.
There is a lot of worry about that, yes. Like, oh my God, they won't understand if there aren't smartphones and if it isn't the exact kind of smartphone that kids are going to be using 2 years from now when this book is actually published. Look into the future, author! Look into the future!
Gosh, do you want to read a book, or a series of books, I should say, that was written over a period of the 1950s to 1999, and every single one of them, besides the lack of technology, could have been written yesterday? The Ramona books are a masterclass in the eternal narrative.
Yes. No kidding. That's always what I bring up when I talk about this kind of thing. The Ramona books are still, I heard a mom talking to another mom today as they dropped their kids off in my classroom and talking about reading the Ramona books with their young 6 and 7 year olds. They're still getting read, and no one is going, where's Bezos' smartphone, and how come Ramona can't just, like, watch ElsaGate on YouTube? There will be an ElsaGate reference in every other episode of this podcast, because I remain fascinated by
it. It's so interesting. Like, there's so much I want to talk about, like, the politics and the aesthetics of toy tubers. and I have nowhere to talk about it, maybe I should start another podcast.
The thing is, I would want to be on that podcast. It would just be the same podcast. We'd just be like wearing literal different hats to make us look different.
Oh my gosh. You should wear the Elsa crown.
Oh, yes.
So, the Ramona books, you know, were written. The first one was in, Fesis and Ramona was written in the 1950s. The latest was written in 1999. And the themes of them and the internal struggles of Ramona and the details of her life so easily can be transposed to modern times. And because the overarching theme is her family's struggle with money, it very easily explains the lack of new technology.
That is a really good point. I was also going to say that a lot of the little incidental bits in the Ramona books come from Beverly Cleary's own childhood, like taking one bite of the apple and then throwing it away because nothing tastes as good as the first bite of the apple. Things that happen to her kids, things that happen to people that she grew up with, or news stories that she collected when she was becoming a writer. Like, it's universal themes of childhood and growing up. Like, the first bite of an apple is always going to taste the best. That's been true for centuries.
Yes.
That's never gonna change. And, you know, Beverly Cleary doesn't have to get all like Judy Blume about it and update the technology because an apple is an apple.
Mm-hmm. And art teachers.
An apple is not a tampon.
So, in the same way that narrative is timeless, I feel like there's a lot of this queer coming of age story that will be timeless to older readers, because I don't know if a younger reader who is going through this period of life themselves, if they will feel removed enough from it to look at it as the historical document and not the call to action, except for the call to action to make life more interesting.
Yes. I think we have a lot to talk about regarding creative vandalism.
Yes.
First, I want to point out, as you know, and hopefully our readers and listeners know as well, there is more and more good YA lit out there about contemporary teens coming out, learning about their sexuality.
Just existing.
Existing, being people.
Being people, like having adventures, fighting monsters.
Yeah.
Meeting cute girls and finding the perfect couch. I want that couch.
Except yeah, it's that, out there.
Except I have cats. Oh my gosh. Ramona and KB, say hi to the podcast. I think we just quieted them down, actually. They're at a very, very mouthy age. A little sidebar. Readers and listeners, how do you feel about being hashtag wayfinders? Let us know. It's fewer letters. I mean, you'll always be your readers and listeners. We just need something hashtagable.
Make us feel like we have a fandom, please. And if you want to start subgroups, go ahead. If you want to start Wayfinders who were born in Westfield, I know there's two of you out there.
If you
start your own group, guys.
If you want to start A Camp Wayfinders, I know there's at least two of you out there. It's not a rule, but it's a, we will frown if you do this. Don't make groups that exclude people or make them feel bad for existing unless they're Nazis.
Yeah, I feel like that shouldn't have to be said, and yet here we are in this world, so.
There's so many things I never imagined myself having to actually point out.
No kidding. Except I'm a preschool teacher, so I'm used to telling people all day long that they should have like basic human respect for each other.
Have you seen that article, Things They Say to Toddlers and Also Adult Men?
That sounds like my life. Please send that to me.
I'll send it to you and I'll put it in our social media and our show notes.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
So we were on about something. Remind me what we were on about.
Creative vandalism. We were going to start talking about that.
Creative vandalism is how Edward Zani and his friends decide to entertain themselves the summer before senior year. Because, you know, they live in suburban New Jersey. They can get into the city and do go into the city, but it's expensive. It takes time. They're like, let's make some fun in our own town. And I've got a description right here. Let me pull it up. This is what drew me into the book, I think. I was clicking around Amazon and I saw the Amazon review, which is glowing. And it mentioned this and it reminded me of guerrilla art and glamour bombing, which, you know, are my thing. I didn't really do much of either besides drawing bookmarks and leaving them in library books. And I'm sorry, librarians. I tried to be as non-invasive as possible.
Are you looking for like around page 34 or so?
37-ish.
Aha.
I can't meowing believe it. There's a Buddha on my memories. In a moment of blazing insight, I spontaneously leap from the car and start tucking and rolling my way across the lawn like I'm avoiding snipers. I can hear my friends' bewildered cries behind me, but that only invigorates me all the more as I zigzag across the lawn to the Buddha and plop my Burger King crown on his head at a rakish angle. I swear, it was like he was meant to wear it. It's almost like he's smiling because he knows he looks so snazzy. In that moment, the manifesto for the summer of magic and mischief is born. We call it creative vandalism. Our commitment is to bring a Bobby and a chorus line kind of flair and vitality to the sleepy New Jersey suburbs, but with Paula's proviso that we don't do any damage to personal property or engage in any illegal activity. It's such a Paula proviso to have. So when they make a movie of my life, the summer of 1983 has to be one of those montage sequences filled with madcap adolescent hijinks. Not the dumb shit you usually see in movies like lip-syncing into hairbrushes or squirting each other with the hose while washing a car. No, you'll see cool creative vandalism stuff we really do, like putting department store mannequins in compromising positions or hopping in the freezer section of the grocery store and pretending to be the cryogenically frozen Walt Disney. We call it Disney on Ice. You'll see us on those summer nights as we tool around in the Lincoln Continental Divide. Paula, the designated driver, the rest of us, the designated drunks, putting dishwashing liquids in fountains downtown till it bubbles over, sending Paula's enormous bra up the school flagpole, drawing a hula hoop around the guy in the crosswalk sign, and of course, visiting the Buddha.
So good. Yeah. So fun.
Fun to read about, but
yeah.
Don't make retail workers' life miserable. Just don't. Don't do things that make their lives harder, please.
Yeah, all of these things sound like great ideas when you're 17. And I had a lot of really dumb ideas like this as a teenager, so I understand it. But speaking from way on the other side of that, be nice.
Be nice.
Be kind. Be kind and considerate. And don't make anyone's life harder than it needs to be. And I say this as someone who once left a Cabbage Patch doll with a note saying, please adopt this baby, and left it on a neighbor's porch, rang the doorbell, ran away, and then had to continue running because the neighbor came out with a baseball bat and chased me down the block.
You're giving away all the fun from our staff meetings. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's the problem with public whimsy in New York City, and apparently in Sloopity-boop down in Flimflamville. It can be very dangerous, but it's a lot of fun to read about.
Yeah.
Much like sex as
maybe
a teenager.
Maybe like draw, Yeah.
Sorry.
I was going to say, draw a nice flower in some sidewalk chalk on the sidewalk in front of your house. Tell someone that they look nice.
Seed an empty lot with local wildflower seeds.
Oh my God, we need to make this list. Yes. Like so many of the lists that were going around on the internet at the time this book was published.
Yes.
And I still have some of them. I still have some of them printed out in old journals. We need to do
when we meet up, can we bring our journals and like compare them at the live show? Because I have one right next to the computer at this moment, filled with like 20 or 30 pages of Glamour Bomb stuff.
Oh my God, yes. Let's take James sedately glamour bombing. You walk into a store, you say to the person behind the counter, "You look nice today," and then you leave quietly so as not to upset anyone.
You tip a barista $2 and you clean up the sugar bar.
Beautiful. But yeah, I did find this quite inspiring and thought it sounded all like a lot of fun, even like in my 20s reading this. Like, I want to go back in time and be a creative vandal again. And I think that's one of the things that the book does really well. And while we're on that subject, like other things the book does really well, it's so good at capturing the interior life of someone who wants to be a performer and someone who, you know, as they said on that incredibly problematic show Glee, but I still think of this all the time, I need applause to live.
That's real.
No. Yeah, that's Edward. That's me, man. And that's okay with me. Like, it's something that I've come to accept about myself. But they're just wonderful passages in here. Like, I'm looking here at chapter 14, when Edward is watching his girlfriend Kelly in The Miracle Worker. "I often forget it's Kelly I'm watching, so swept away am I by her performance. I had no idea she could be so good. She's so real, so harrowing, it makes me want to cry, assuming I could do that kind of thing. Partly because I'm so proud of her, and partly because I want so desperately to be up there myself, being real and harrowing." And that is me from the time I was age 3 and I went to see my first performance. My first, like, play, and I was furious that I wasn't in it. I wanted to be on stage. How come all these other people were on stage? I wanted to be on stage, too. And, man, that's just been my entire life.
I remember one of the first live stage shows I saw when I was probably about 6 or 7 was a performance, like a live nativity. And when Jesus was born, I was so overcome, I cried. And my mom said, if you can't, well, she thought I was scared of the crowd. So she's like, if you can't handle this, we're going home. And meanwhile, I was just like, no, it's so moving.
Yeah.
It's just so beautiful. It's our savior.
Yeah, Edward gets at that at the end when he is playing Jesus in Godspell. He says, this is what being an actor is about. To be able to elicit such a strong reaction from hundreds of people at once. That power is awesome and irresistible and humbling. If you want to think I'm needy because I love applause, go ahead. But I know that the reason I perform is for moments like these. Moments when you connect with an audience and take them somewhere. Whether it's scary or funny or sad, it doesn't matter. That's what makes it worthwhile. Like, yes.
Yeah.
You get it, Edward. You understand.
So I've decided I'm going to write a later in life conversion memoir of a honorary Jewish girl who gets in with the crowd of Godspell Christians. I'm going to call it Surprised by Goys.
Oh, that's beautiful.
That's another nice thing about this book. There is a lot of tenderness and also a lot of taking the piss at Catholicism, and especially Roman Catholic Italian, Roman Catholic, like, isms, and all the little cultural bits that you get if you were raised in it.
Right. There's a lot that I cannot identify with as an Irish Roman Catholic, but I found myself wondering how true it felt to you and whether you were enjoying it from the insider's perspective.
Everyone has an Aunt Glow. Mine was my Grandma Gloria. That was pretty spot on, my Grandma Gloria, except, you know, thankfully all three of her boys are alive and well. and none of them are priests, which is good for the priesthood. And for me and my brother. Although when my dad retires, I'm going to tell him to be a deacon to keep himself busy.
Yes.
you need to stay entertained. You're like a toddler.
Oh my god.
Yeah, boomer parents.
Don't talk to me about retired parents.
Yeah, boomer parents, if you don't have, like, a snack and entertainment in your back pocket at all times, you know, woe betide you.
Never leave the house without at least 3 squeezy applesauces, okay?
I love squeezy applesauces.
So do all of my 3-year-olds.
Oh my gosh, I had to buy baby food for the kittens because they were being very, like, they were just weaned, and it's like, this is not mama's milk. What is this weird thing in a can you're giving me? So I had to give them baby food. So I was buying, like, cat food and then also baby food, and I kept wondering if the cashiers were like, is this how she's stretching it out? This is not good.
Oh my god.
No, I promise, they're baby cats. They're yeah. Anyway.
Look, just because I dress them up in diapers and bonnets doesn't mean I don't know the difference between babies and cats.
So speaking of parents, there's a really terrible one in this one.
Oy. Yeah. One of those, like, if you have daddy issues, maybe you will feel better about your own daddy issues when you read this book.
Especially the end.
Yeah.
The end is triumphant. And it has...
Oh my god.
It has an actual Dea Ex Machina in it. And it's so good. But it has to, because...
I love it.
It's... You can see Marcosito, the playwright and a musical writer, in this book. And this is something I'm noticing on this read. Of course, it works very well as a novel. But you can see the slapstick and you can see the dialogue and, like, how his wheels turn. And I think that's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. I would have loved to have seen the stage performance of this. It was a one-man show, correct?
One man playing 20 characters.
Oh, and I bet he was so good.
He looks exactly like how I pictured Ed, too. There was video, yeah, but I couldn't access it. So Marcosito also wrote Allegiance.
I don't know what that is. Is.
That's the one about Japanese American internees with,
oh my god,
yeah, with
no way,
George Takei.
Yeah. Okay. I totally know what that is, but Marquesita was not a name that I was ever associating with that.
I just learned it myself. Also, I'm correcting myself. It's George Takei, like toupee.
Yes.
And also,
yes.
You should watch his roast of William Shatner because it's brilliant.
Yes. I know he's problematic, but that was funny.
Yes. Like, don't give money to his projects, but do watch that video. Because William Shatner is also problematic.
Yes. Well, we knew that.
Yeah.
Oh my God, there he is, Mark Aceto.
And
you go, Mark. That's amazing.
He wrote a good piece in... I mean, I can't really judge if it's a good piece. Because, you know, I am not Asian. But he wrote a piece about, you know, doing meowed up yellow face in his opera days. And then getting to be a better person and not doing that. And having... Japanese American people trust him with their story. As the kids say, Marquesito got woke after the election, and his blog is super political now, and I love it.
Wow.
Because writers are going to lead us toward the revolution. Writers and service workers.
Writers and, yeah.
It's, I once told somebody, be careful what you say about the gays, because we're everywhere, but especially in the service industry and the medical industrial complex. And it's true. You ever need a social worker and you don't like gays, woe betide you.
Yeah.
So.
Let's talk about sexuality in this book. I've got my journal here from when I finished reading it the first time, and what I wrote about in this entry was mostly about how validated I felt reading it as a bisexual person, reading a book where the bi characters remain bi the whole time. There's no retconning, Joss Whedon style, like, now I'm gay, or I was straight all along. You know, we are fond of using that line from Boy Meets Boy, but it's true, Edward Zani is definitely bi and has a strong sense of self, and his girlfriend, same thing.
That is a wonderful scene, by the way.
Oh my God, yes. Still think you're bisexual? Hell yes. Yep, it doesn't change. So even with all the things about this book that are difficult and unfortunate, it has a special place in my heart for that, and I think it always will.
That is... 100% relatable. And I know that I identified with it because at the time, girl-girl narratives were pretty deathly, and even now we have a dearth of humor. Which stings, because, like, queer women are some of the funniest people I know.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I would love to see a novel like this, but with a femme narrator. I think it would be so much fun. Yes. And, you know, I identify, you know, at the time I identified more with these, you know, flamboyant gay narrators because, you know, that personality was much more natural to me. I was like a theater kid without a theater. What happened was, I watched Camp and Fame in the same month and got scared away from the stage.
Oh my God. Yeah. If I had watched Camp during my formative years instead of in my 20s past my theater days, I can see how I would have been scared off as well.
Yeah, now I just have nice queer people who want me to write things for them to perform and or to do monologues and their stuff. And I'm like, that's great. And also podcasting. Podcasting is great because you don't have to put on makeup. You don't have to be a certain look. You can just talk into a microphone.
I love how you went to makeup. I was going to say you don't have to put on pants.
Yeah, I do have, it's a little chilly. I do have pajama pants on. I also have kittens with sharp, precious little claws.
Yes, that is true. Rocky does not tend to get at me like that.
Oh, good boy.
Hey, we should talk about fashion. Were right. There is amazing fashion in this book.
So this is early 80s, the beginning of Madonna, who gets a short cameo in the book where I can't remember if it's Ed or Nady who is there. In every group of friends, there's the fixer, and Nady is the fixer. And I love him because of that. And I think if he had been a girl character, I would have had a giant crush on him. Because he's kind of a schlemiel, but he is so enthusiastic, so much love what he does. He's a little awkward, but he wants to help his friends, and he will.
And he's also an evil genius.
Yes.
I love Nady so much.
Like, he will break every law to get his friends what they want and need and take care of them.
And he will pull all of his other friends along with him. I love that. Like, he gives some great rallying the troops speeches.
Yes.
Like, come on, guys. Don't you care if Edward gets into college? Don't you care if he can pay for college? Come on, everybody. Let's go frame the son of a U.S. senator.
Yeah, he's so good. Where was I going with this?
Something about fashion.
Fashion. So Madonna gets mentioned, and either Edward or Nady is like, oh, her, she's just a flash in the pan. So you'll be able to correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this is when we are going from, like, these soft florals to the bright neons of, like, Cindy and Madonna and the bangles.
Yeah, you know, things were coming very slowly to my hometown, and also I was very young, but 83 was really when I started becoming aware of pop music, and then certainly 84, I was very aware and very into, as a little girl, Madonna and Cyndi Lauper, and what my friends and I considered a punk aesthetic, but we didn't really know what punk was. We just heard the word and we saw things on MTV. We thought that Twisted Sister was a bunch of girls because we were very small and very confused. And so, like, we wanted to look like Dee Snider. We wanted to be beautiful like Dee Snider.
Don't we all?
Yeah. He wrote what I remember as being a really great, like, guide to surviving your teenage years.
That's fascinating. That's something we should possibly get for a special episode of.
Yeah.
Because there's...
We would read that one and Dick Clark's. They were shelved next to each other in my hometown library, which probably tells you what you need to know about my hometown library. But I did read both of them.
My favorite was by Kennedy the VJ. I read it
over
and over. And I feel like we need to get these and read them for an episode.
Yes. Yes, this will happen.
Yes.
But yeah, we're getting into, like, neon land. And we are, like, Madonna is becoming a phenomenon. Cyndi Lauper is becoming a phenomenon. Like, enough that those of us who are very tiny suburban children know who they are and aspire to be them.
And this book is notable for having a fashionable fat girl, not only in the early aughts literature, which there was, like, basically none. And, like, back then, and even in some ways to this day, fat teens get the short end of the stick in a lot of ways. We don't always get to have a lot of fun.
And, Paula gets to have fun.
Paula gets to have so much fun, and she has a
I love Paula.
She has a fantastic sense of style that also shows how much she has to rig up from being in the theater, because it was like polyester horror show back in the day, especially for a teenager. So I have a description of what are her outfits for our fashion corner.
Oh, yes.
Today she's wearing the dress she made out of her father's white Oxford shirt, a flattering choice given that he's about 6'2" and I'd say 300 pounds. So it achieves the desired effect of making her appear small by comparison. The look is completed with a black felt pork pie hat, a multicolored Guatemalan vest with tiny mirrors on it, and a pair of pumps, one red and one gold. Paula. She also has a piano key tie that she gives to Doug.
Edward's girlfriend, Kelly, is very classic 80s. It says, Kelly's wearing lace tights, a fuchsia miniskirt, and a pink cotton sweater worn off her left shoulder, flash dance style, balanced by a ponytail and a huge lace bow on the right side of her head. Like, that side ponytail was like the dream at this point. Like, all I wanted was for my mom to let me to go to school wearing just one side ponytail, and she would not do it.
Do we want to steve in who these play people are?
I think we should probably talk about them a little bit. We've said their names and we've said little things about them. So why don't we talk a bit about the characters? We've got Edward, who's our protagonist. We have said quite a bit about him. We talked a little bit about his neighbor, Nady, referred to as the cheesehead of the group. We talked about him. Kelly is like very classic 80s heroine, just like the outfit she's wearing that we just talked about. And then there's Doug and Paula. And we've talked a bit about Paula. She is kind of Edward's adopted sister in some ways. I mean, they call each other sis and bro. And she is the fat girl with the fabulous style and the girl who gets to have all the fun and adventures that a skinny girl would get to have. And thank you for that, Marcosito.
And sex.
Yes.
It's not very good, but most beginning sex isn't, to be honest.
Yeah. I feel like that was the most realistic sexual aspect of this novel, that Paula didn't have such a great time of it. Like, the rest of them are having these, like, very sophisticated threesomes and being very attentive to each other's needs in a way that I can't imagine most 17-year-old boys or girls being. And Paula's like, yeah, all this guy wanted was to grab my boobs. And also his dick was small.
They called me a slut. Isn't that wonderful?
Oh my God. Oh my God, that was so me in my early 20s.
Love it. I don't miss those days. Because I'm making any judgments about how many people you date or sleep with. That's all your business. I made some poor decisions. You can read all about them in my memoir, Surprised by Goys.
Coming out next year. Get writing. And then there's Doug.
Then there's Doug, who is the archetypical jock who has theater and possibly bisexual leanings, who Ed is over the moon in love with, and as such does some really creepy things with his feelings, which are creepy and invasive and borderline assaulty, also realistic for a 17-year-old boy with nobody to discuss these things. Like, it's not an excuse. It's just like,
right,
nobody was talking about that. He has, especially if this is based on reality, like, there's no context for any of that. It's, you know, meow, you got mine.
Yeah.
Especially for guys.
All right. Wow. We've been talking about this book for a long time.
We have. And I feel like we've barely scratched the surface.
I know.
How do people do book podcast in half an hour. Can you tell us how you do that?
Well, Betsy and Kate do it by reading picture books.
Okay, that's it. Only YA picture books from now on.
Yeah, like if we want to talk about, it's hard to summarize the plot of this book. Like the word Byzantine was invented for the plot of this book. I mean, you know from the title, Edward's trying to pay for college. These are all the things in the subtitle that happen as he tries to pay for college. We've alluded to a whole lot of crime and criminal proceedings. I don't think that I could successfully summarize everything that happens, especially without like giving stuff away that's really fun to read about. Edward tries to pay for college. He does. The end.
The line I think of is the end of the movie of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And where Gene Wilder goes, do you know what happened to the boy who got everything he ever wanted? He lived happily ever after. That's this book.
Mm-hmm.
It's just this. There's several hundred pages of that first, leading up to that first sentence.
And then there's also a sequel.
Yeah, and there's a threequel. Mark Aceto, Manic Depress, wants to publish your book. Get in touch with them. Get in touch with me, and I'll get you in touch with them. They want that book so badly.
I want that book.
Like, honestly, nowadays, he could probably self-publish and do well, as long as they don't have the rights
to it. Dude, for real, yeah.
And I don't think it works like that. I don't think publishers get rights to characters like that.
No.
I mean, it's not...
No, from my limited understanding.
Yeah, so, Mark, like, 80s nostalgia is so big right now.
Well, this could be even 90s nostalgia.
That's right, because
people really want...
Please, Mark, let us know how we can bring the jazz hands of God to life. We will be your evangelists.
If it means never taking your brother's name in vain again, I'm sorry that I created hashtag the Aceto Prophecy. I will never, ever say it again.
So, any final thoughts, Carrie?
Man, I think what I said earlier still goes, that as many things there are in this book that are problematic or that could hurt someone or that could or should be changed, it remains important to me. It's a problematic fave. And that, I guess, is something that I have to accept about myself and about this thing that has been important to me. You know, I respect a lot of what Mark Aceto was doing, and I think that there's a place for this book. Just not on the YA shelf and not without a lot of content warnings preceding it. How about you? Final thoughts?
It's hard to return to a book and think about it in terms of ways that it can be harmful. But I also feel like that's just sort of the duty of us as readers. And I think it's important to kind of hold the place that got something out of this book and also hold authors and the literary canon to do better. And from looking at Mark Aceto's current writing and how passionate he is about social causes, and even his mission statement on his website, which is, "My mission is to bring social change with work that celebrates and investigates our shared humanity." Like, he's a good guy. He wrote a book in 2004 about cusp of the AIDS crisis, queer teens making trouble. And I think it's a book, you know, we have Raghunathan's Law. For every book, their reader, and every reader, their book. And this is, and I am sure this book has its readers. And I think that with a little retooling, it could find even more readers nowadays. And I think better reflect the compassion that I see Marcosito expresses in his current writing.
Yeah, some things to think about for book three.
Yeah.
You can do it, Mark. We believe in you.
You can totally do it. You're a smart guy with a lot of talent. And, you know, I am thankful for this book and what it was for me. Because at the time, it was reflecting of the experience I was having. And I didn't have a lot of that. And, you know, as problematic as it is for a lot of queer women to have had to turn to, you know, gay male literary canon for that, you know, we had it. And I do appreciate it because writing a book and publishing a book especially is always something to celebrate. And it's a book that gave me a lot of hope. And that's something I can always be grateful for.
That's beautiful.
Thank you. Carrie, do you have a read-alike?
I do. And my read-alike is Life is Like a Musical: How to Live, Love, and Lead Like a Star by Tim Federle.
Interesting. And
he is also the author of the Better Nate Than Ever books.
Right.
Yep. He was a Broadway dancer who then became a writer and has also written a few cocktail recipe books, which I still haven't picked up, but I'm very intrigued by. But this book just came out last year, so it's written from a, you know, 2017 perspective. So I feel like it's a book that's going to be more inclusive. And it's a how-to book. It's like a little self-help guide about how to live like Edward Zani, but without hurting people.
That's great.
How about you? What's your read-alike this week?
I Married an Earthling by Alvin Orloff, published in 2000, and I can do no better than the official description. In this rollicking send-up of traditional science fiction, Earth Studies professor Norvek Seven from the planet Xeron decides to increase his university status by visiting Earth, accompanied by Viva 22, a chic hairdresser of the highest social order. Mistaken for evil villains and harmless frauds instead of the fabulous celebrities they are, Norvex ends up in San Francisco, where all hell breaks loose when he crosses paths with the adolescent agony of Chester Julian, a gay goth teenager. Part Jacqueline Susan romantic fantasy, part cheesy Lost in Space episode, this gay comedy will delight any fan of pop culture literature.
That sounds great.
It's so much fun. It's got a lot of that 90s Gen X nostalgia for the 60s and 70s. And from I have not done a close read recently, but from what I remember, a lot of his humor punches up. And that's great.
That sounds nice.
Yeah. No, all of this humor is it's aimed upward. And it's also a book where the fat boy gets the guy. And he doesn't have to lose weight. He loves him just as he is. And the fact that I am surprised by this in the year of our Lord 2018. Yeah.
Yep.
We've gotten better. We've gotten better in the past couple of years. But, oh boy. Literature was not kind to fat chicks when we were growing up.
Oh, no.
What are you currently reading, Carrie?
I just finished Love and Other Train Wrecks by Leah Conan, and I have been on the fence about whether or not it's something that I want to recommend, but ultimately, what I'm going with is a recommendation because of the portrayal of a parent with mental illness. What are you currently reading?
I just finished The Merry Spinster by Daniel Ortberg.
Yes! Oh my god, I'm so excited for that!
Oh, it is. If you know and love your toast and fairy tales made horrifying, you know what you're getting into. It is equal parts terrifying and cathartic. It is one of my favorite reads of the year to date. 2018 is young, but I have a feeling this is going to be near the top of the list.
Oh, wow. I'm so, so excited for that. I think I'm going to buy it this week.
I was in the same building as Daniel Ortberg on Monday. A friend and I were shopping at the Strand while an event for The Merry Spinster was going on, and we considered going up, but I was not feeling and looking my best. And, you know, I'm in a relationship, but I'm also not dead. So,
no kidding.
So I was not ready yet. And I wanted to focus all my time on my friend who was visiting from Seattle. Hi, Alia. Friend of the podcast, Alia, who's really cool and working on a podcast of her own.
Yay. Readers and listeners, you can get in touch with us and send us compliments and send us critiques. Send us questions. Please do not send us any giant Buddhas. We live in small apartments. I'm not sure where we would put them.
We definitely don't have yards. I mean, maybe you have a yard. Technically, I have a yard, but it's a shared yard.
I have a tiny shared balcony onto which I could place a teeny tiny Buddha, possibly. But don't go getting any ideas.
You can find us at Go Your Own YA at all the usual hotspots, except Instagram. We are Go Your Own YA Podcast there. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and goyourownya@gmail.com. Drop us a line, leave us a review. We'd love to hear what's working and what's not.
And I think that's it for this week. This has been Go Your Own YA. I'm Carrie.
And I'm Marie. Do something good for yourself.
And bad for the patriarchy.
Yay! We did it!
Yay! We got through it!